Welcome to Doctorate, the podcast of PhD candidates in the humanities and the social sciences at the University of Vienna.
This is the place for communication and discussion about issues surrounding us in the world of science. We address the whats, whys, and hows of our work and invite researchers from different disciplines to explore topics and ideas they and we deeply care about.
Hello and welcome to today's episode of Doctorate. Today we're going to be discussing the topic of AI in academia. My name is Emily Kate and I am your host. We're joined in the studio today by two doctoral candidates, Marvin and Michaela. Would you like to introduce yourselves and tell the listeners a little bit about your research?
Yeah, hi. I'm Michaela. I'm doing my PhD at the Doctoral School of Historical and Cultural Studies, actually in the field of digital humanities. And I'm doing this in context of an Austrian Science Fund funded project, which is called Ottoman Nature in Travelogues. And there, basically, we are looking to train AI models to automatically find nature representation in images and texts of travelogues.
And I'm Arvin. I'm a PhD candidate at the Doctoral School of Social Sciences in Communication Science. And I mostly work on political identities and social identities in political communication and how they've evolved over time.
So because of today's topic being AI in academia, we would love to hear about your first introduction to AI.
So actually, I at least consciously only started to use AI in context of my doctorate. I actually started last year. And before that, I didn't code anything. So I really started developing or programming in Python last year. And actually, for coding, for me, it was very important to kind of be able to find, I don't know, for instance, error messages I encountered, or just like, you know, understand some code snippets or some concepts. And I used actually Google search for that for a long time until, I mean, I kept on hearing from the colleagues that I should definitely try GPT-3. And when I started to do it, I basically just use that for now because it's really such efficient, especially if you are looking up things for Python programming. It's very good at basically leading you to a good answer very much quicker than if you try to look it up in Google and in forums and so on.
So I think in my personal life, it might have been Clippy that I encountered first, who was this always there, not always helpful assistant we had in Word, who I think at some point mostly became annoying because he was taking up screen space and was always very chirpy and telling you, hello, I'm going to help you. And I think since then it's become more common, also in my academic use, both in personal and private use. Yeah,
absolutely. So when it comes to academic use, I'd love to hear both of you expound upon your use of AI in your research, in your studies.
So as I already said, in the ONET project, we're looking to use AI to retrieve information related to nature in basically our multimodal material, which is images and texts, and it's historical images and texts. So what we are doing is actually adapting modern models to retrieve contents, specific contents in images and texts, to adapt them to our historical material. And basically what I am looking into for that is with a CLIP model. CLIP, I don't want to be too technical now, but it basically is a model that combines the analysis of images and textual explanations of the content of the image. And this basically allows you to query either the images or the texts in a multimodal way. So for instance, what the first prototype of the fine-tuned model that we have finalized just now is capable to search the images from the travelogues with a text prompt. And the cool thing, I mean, of course, this is something that Google can do, but the cool thing is really that it basically works because the vector representation of the text and the images are projected into the same vector space. And by calculating basically the similarity between the two, you can find images that are similar to a text prompt, or also an image that is similar to other images. And this is very cool, I think.
For me, it is mostly based around text analysis, because we've seen, especially in our field, but in the social sciences in general, people being very excited that they do not have to count things by hand anymore. And there's lots of exciting developments and questions of how you might use these. And so in my case, I'm using them to deal with large quantities of text and, for example, find specific information that I want to later analyze on, or also use them as analysis methods. So, for example, if I have political statements, for example, by political parties or political leaders, I might have questions like, you know, is this sentence, for example, mentioning emotional content? Is this sentence referring to morality dimensions? And all of these are things that are slightly easier if you have automated help for that and you don't have to do it all by yourself.
So we've heard a little bit about your first introductions to AI and how you're incorporating AI into your research currently. I'd love to hear from both of you about where you see this going, about the development and the future of AI, both in society and in academia.
In the digital humanities field, of course, people tend to be very excited about AI and applications of it. In the historical research, sometimes not so much. But I think that in general, the possibility to apply machine learning or other AI components helps you really to deal with the huge quantities of data that are presently still being digitized. And for instance, in our project, we are looking at more than 2,500 travel reports spanning from the 16th to the 19th century. So it's a really large corpus, and we wouldn't be able to look through it by hand in the course of the project. So my take on it is really that it enables you to use the data in a different way and also to answer different questions than more traditional methods. And I think that this is very exciting.
Yeah, I think it will definitely lead to changes that maybe also no one really currently can foresee. I think we probably both have doomsday sayers and techno-utopian prophets there, and probably will fall somewhere in the middle, but I think there's exciting possibilities for researchers. And also, so Michaela said, I think there's more people from interdisciplinary backgrounds coming in there, and I think it's really opening up fields that might have been previously restricted to more technologically oriented or minded education programs, actually to a wider source of people. And I think that's exciting developments, as long as we keep critically reflecting on what we're actually doing and what we're using these for.
Love these cautiously optimistic viewpoints. So just for our listeners as well, I'd love to hear more. Each of you are using AI for such specific elements of support in your research. I'd love to hear the forms of AI that you are using and learn a little bit more about that for our listeners.
Yeah, so as I said, I'm working with a multimodal model, which basically means that it combines different modes. So one is image and the second one is text. And this basically is a very versatile model or a versatile approach, let's say. Of course, it's also motivated by the specific perspective that we have in the project, because the ultimate goal is really to analyze image and text relations. So this kind of came naturally to look into this kind of models, and also the CLIP model. I mean, there are other similar models out there, but CLIP was actually the first one that very successfully was able to combine these two modalities. And it's also called a seminal model because it is applicable to very broad application areas. As I said, you can use it to search images or texts, but in principle, you can also adapt it for instance, object detection tasks. So this would be that you don't just want to recognize, in our case now, that an image is an image of an animal, but for instance, you can then also recognize if there is a very small animal or several small animals on an image. And this can also be a very important use case.
Yeah, definitely. Similar to that, I'm more focused only on the textbook, like we said, for example, finding things. Also, by now, models are becoming slightly more flexible or slightly less restrictive than they might have been in the past. So you might have a wider flexibility, for example. So say you wanted to find some mentions of a certain concept always, and you have a large scale of text data. And then you don't only have to now maybe look for exact matches of a phrase. So say you were looking for appeals to emotions, for example, you don't have to always look for the word sad when the word sad is mentioned exactly, because speech varies and lots of people speak differently and there's different speaking styles and rhetorical styles. We might also now be actually able to find words that are similar to sad but are not exactly sad. And I think there's more flexibility that we can use. And I mean, also just on a practical level, most of the doctoral candidates at our schools, I think, are not native English speakers. So I think we all really enjoy getting corrections and suggestions for you've started five sentences in a row with the same article, or this sentence is 60 characters, so 60 words long. Maybe no one besides you will understand it. So I also very much in the day-to-day life rely on like smaller tasks where that can be very helpful to have an outsider's perspective.
I love hearing about the benefits, about the use cases. I would also like to hear about margins of error, about misuse, you know, about general issues that can occur in general, but also specifically in your research as well.
So one specific challenge that we have is that the modern models are trained on large data sets that were scraped from the internet. Specifically, the CLIP model was released by OpenAI. The model itself was released publicly, so it's an open source project, but the data set that they use to train their model is closed. There is a newer version of CLIP that was done by another institution, and they basically retrained the full model with a data set that they scraped similarly from the internet using the images and the alternative text descriptions of the images. And I think it's like 4 billion images that they used for that. And that data set was published. And there have been studies looking at this data set. And of course, there is a lot of problematic data in there. And we need to be always conscious that by reusing these models, even though we, of course, fine-tune them to fit them to our own data, they will still carry that information and the bias specifically from the original data set that they were trained on with. And this is something that we need to be very careful about, because we cannot simply use these models and like take the results without, you know, thinking about them. We always need to assess what possible bias is in there, like racial bias. Like, I mean, there is a lot of bias that is in there. And we, of course, in the project, took the approach to analyze nature representation, which is probably a less problematic topic. So it's, of course, also a way to kind of circumvent a bit the more problematic bias issues that come with these models. But still, it is something that we always need to be careful with and definitely take into consideration when reusing these models.
Yeah, I think in the worst case, like you said, they can just, we can reinforce the existing inequalities and biases that we have both in society, but also within academia. We see that, for example, in specifically social scientists that use text analysis methods and use AI and computer-assisted methods for analyzing texts, that a lot of research is Eurocentric and American-centric, and a lot of research is English-centric. And so you're always in the easiest, best position. You will have the best tools and support and widest array of everything available if you're working in English. And then the further down on the popularity scale of languages you go, there's languages like Hindi that are spoken by very many people that are very, I would say, poorly represented currently by mainstream academic discourse and research, just because research interests and research funding and the hot research topics are usually stuff centered around European and North American languages. So we have we are reinforcing kind of inequalities that we already have in the academic system, and we definitely need to make sure that we also represent both minority languages, but also languages like Hindi, for example, that are not even a minority language, that are just badly served by current academic focus.
That's a really interesting point. I think with this sort of discussion of use case issues, errors, and limitations, we've also sort of come across this concept of issues with morality. And I know that one of the most sort of hotly discussed topics surrounding AI and morality exists within the permissions and the consent for the use of the models, sort of the data sets that we use to train these AI algorithms. So I would love to hear, I know that Michaela, you were discussing that you are using data sets to train an AI that will then you can query and then be given a response and be sort of pointed in the right direction, which is distinct from these types of AIs where you put in a prompt and then it generates an artwork. So can you talk a little bit about the nuance of the use of, you know, visual assets to create data sets that are then used to train these models?
Yeah, that's actually a very interesting question, because exactly the model that I am using for the research is the same model that is also integrated in at least one of these generative AI models that generate images. So basically, I'm using a very similar architecture with the same database on it. And I think that, of course, for people who are living from artworks that they do or whatever artistic expression they just make their everyday money from it, of course, for them, this is a big threat. And especially if you know that in this data, there must also be some of your own art that was used to retrain the model. And now it's basically taking something of your artwork and of your copyrighted material to produce new data that other people can then make money out of it. This is, of course, a huge problem. I would try to make a distinction between this sort of uses and academic use. Of course, academic use should also think about these problems. But since academic use normally is less driven by profit and making money out of things, and is more driven by progressing the technology and the field, I think you can make some sort of distinction there. But of course, it is still something that researchers should be very aware of, and also cautious of where the data comes from or where the model comes from that they are reusing. And I think that to some point, I think it's very important that we use this technology and analyze this technology and see how far we can go with it. But in the end, we should never just take the output from such a model and use it without thinking of what the consequences or the connotations also are.
Like you said, I think there's a very human tendency that I definitely notice in myself, that I like shiny things and I like new things. And technological advances are always shiny and new, but usually technological advances come probably out of commercial companies, and that usually should take a bit of time. If something is released yesterday, probably today you have not completed all necessary checks and balances that you should do before you can use it for academic work, meaning you can verify that what it does is actually what it does, and you have an overview of how this thing that you're using was produced and employed, and you know that it actually happened in an ethically and fair way. So I think it's good, I think, to get excited and to speculate and imagine the utopian futures that we might have, but also to keep those impulses in check and do all the slightly more boring housekeeping tasks that we should do to actually be, you know, to before you introduce a new tool into your tools kit, you should check that before the new drill that you use doesn't actually destroy the wall, but it is a drill and it's not too powerful for your house, but it's actually just appropriate for the task.
Absolutely. And you've both really touched on a very interesting topic, which is when we use AI in academia, what considerations must we take in order to ensure that we are using it responsibly? Do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, I think also it's I'm definitely more of a just user and benefactor of developments that happen in computer science and in NLP companies. So I think it's very valuable to listen to other voices, because these other voices that probably I wouldn't claim that I can give the all clear for some new technological advance to be, yep, that's good, you should be able to use it. And there's, you know, there's experts that are concerning themselves with ethics, etc., and have good insights there, as well as, of course, as always, marginal voices and actual affected voices. Because, you know, as a white man, it's very easy to say, you know, I don't see any biases here, but probably I will not be affected by these biases. So to actually listen to voices that can tell you, you know, we are concerned about this technology and we see these and these problems, and, you know, they matter. If you choose to use a model that has been criticized for this and that, then these things also matter to you, and you should engage with that, and you cannot just ignore inconvenient voices, maybe, because then you cannot be the fanciest methodological person possible.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. I think it's very important to think about minorities or any other groups that might be affected by the outputs that you are generating with your AI tools. And I think that a particular challenge in that context is that the AI field is moving so quickly because there are so many models that are released and refined, fine-tuned basically every day. And it's very hard to keep pace with it. But of course, if you want to incorporate them responsibly into your research, you need time. You need time to look at the models, to evaluate the models. And usually, at least from my experience, this is something that is not so much funded in projects. I mean, of course, in research projects, it's probably something, especially in EU projects, this is something where they have made sure that there is an ethics focus that is basically required. But to be honest, I think that more resources would be needed for that, to do this properly. At the end, of course, you want to have a working tool, and ideally, probably, you also need to be quick with it, because otherwise someone else will release it before that. But it's a very big challenge, really, if you want to be sure that it's done in a responsible way. This simply takes time and it takes effort, and it takes also experts, really, for ethical concerns. I think that you said this brilliantly. You cannot just stick with the developers with the focus on technical feasibility. You need to interact and include people from the social sciences, ethical experts into the discussion, because otherwise it's just impossible to address this properly. And I think that for this, you really need to have possibilities to fund this and to get the support. I'm actually employed at the Austrian Institute of Technology. It's a big research institute. We have some support, but especially for ethical concerns, this is something that is more difficult to get. Like data protection, this is something that, of course, is mandatory also on the legal side. But ethical concerns, often we still need to be organized on our own. Or, I mean, we have some proponents in our group that are really supporting that and doing this in an organized manner so that we can also profit from it. But yeah, this is really something that takes time. And yeah, still, it's important to take that time in context of the research project.
So with us here, we have sort of representation of somebody who is helping into create an AI that will help researchers and somebody who is using AI in their research. And I'd love to hear a little bit more. We've touched on a lot of different sort of phases of the process of each of your unique pathways. You've discussed collaboration, analysis of data sets and training. And I would love to hear a little bit about sort of the chronology. When you have sat down to plan out your research, plan out your doctoral studies, can you tell us a little bit from the beginning of conceptualizing your projects and then being able to actually use AI, whether you are building new AI or whether you are utilizing it. Can you tell us a little bit about chronologically how that has been for you?
I think it's a lot of grant work because academia, I think, has a tendency, if you start from the end product of any kind of academic research and it's a cool presentation or a fancy research article, everything always looks like a completely seamless process that you 5 years ago had this idea and then you kind of gathered these data and you did these analyses and everything kind of worked out as you planned. And I think mostly that's at least a tiny bit of a small lie because you probably encountered 10 things that went wrong along the way. And I work in a team where everybody, I think, comes from a mostly social science background, but is also has learned programming skills for their tasks. And I think we all share daily frustrations of, yep, I can see how this would be useful. And I think we just, I think maybe that's what motivates or what characterizes all of us is that we say, yeah, we're okay with getting stuck in there and failing lots of times and having to look up lots of things and ask lots of stupid questions. So we're like, okay, I have this research question. I could see that this tool, this methodology might be helpful for this particular question. Actually don't know anything about it, so time to learn and time to spend a week or maybe multiple weeks to discuss with colleagues and to learn something new and to fail in lots of ways and then to find out, yeah, it works for some of the things I thought it would work and for other things it doesn't work. Yeah, so I think you'll always end up somewhere. Probably it's not the point where you started, which is anyways probably what happens during doctoral studies, which probably most people can attest to. And I think at least what I can see in our team is of very different backgrounds, very different research questions that everybody uses. That is just, it's getting your hands dirty and admitting that you sometimes think of non-very obvious things and you'll get there in the end probably.
Yeah, I totally feel you. For me, it's a very similar situation, although I am in a team of developers, basically. It's definitely the case that before you apply a technology, you need to understand it and to get to know it and not only understand how it works, but of course, how you can apply it. How can you fit it or just, you know, use it with your own data? How can you put the data into that model and so on? And for me, it was very valuable to be in this team of technical experts because there, of course, I got a lot of great hints where I could tackle this issue. So maybe the a bit special situation for me in the PhD project is that I joined the PhD project when it was already funded. So basically my position there was already defined before I really, you know, was part of the project. So it was on the one hand already quite clear what my role and my tasks and the goal will be in the project. But it was not so much clear concretely how it needs to be done. And I think one important thing, of course, since it is a very technical element in the project, it needs to be, you know, not only state of the art, it needs to apply state of the art, but then advance the state of the art. And this was why we looked very early into transfer learning, because you already have very well working models. Why training them from scratch yourself? Because with, you know, smaller amounts of data, you can achieve equally or even better results than by, you know, develop it from scratch. And to be honest, I have tried to use Clip out of the box. And I'm still not sure because, yeah, the evaluation is still missing how much the fine-tuning improved the model. But yeah, from my experience, it's really since, you know, the data that you're using it with, if it's very different from the data that it was trained on, it makes sense to at least try it out if it works better.
Amazing. Thank you. I love hearing about sort of your experiences and in keeping with the doctorate tradition. We've asked both of our guests today to sort of think of a physical object that they could bring up that's representative of your relationship with AI. So you both have objects that you'd like to talk about. Would you like to go first?
Yeah, I tried to be imaginative and then I couldn't. And then I just thought of my phone because is a daily companion and helps me a lot and helps me in a lot of ways that I wouldn't be able to do on my own. I've been able to find my way to the podcasting studio, which would have been impossible otherwise, probably. And it's a reflection of, you know, you're probably surrounded by more computer algorithm fancy things that you might think are magic or only they might be embedded more deeply into your life than your daily life, than your actually thinking, including on your phone, and you might be happy that they're helping you out in very small, menial ways. And I'm happy that Siri now can actually set a timer, which for 6 years people complained about. You know, progress is slow.
Yeah, my object is actually an artifact from the 90s because, yeah, what I was asking myself is what object can I connect to the first time that I at least, you know, consciously encountered AI. And I think this was really the time when I watched the first Matrix movie. And I really loved the motion picture soundtrack. So this is actually the object that I was thinking of. For me, it was... It's still today fascinating, this concept of the AI that is capable to take over the world, of course, in a very dystopian way, which is very scary. But then again, for me, this is something that still connects me with this idea of AI. Although, of course, today we can still say very safely that we're miles away from such a scenario. So that's good. But yeah, that's my object.
You know, and on that note, from artifact from the 90s, we will call it a day today. Thank you so much to our guests for, you know, bringing us on this very interesting walk through your minds with regards to AI in academia. We've loved hearing about it. Thank you so much and best of luck with your research. This was episode 13 of Doctorate. It was written and produced by Penelope Faithful, Emily Genitowski, and Martin Picorni. Editing and everything technical by Aditya Sudagoon and Martin Picorni. And I'm your host, Emily Genitowski. Doctorate is brought to you by the Doctoral School of Historical and Cultural Studies and the Vienna Doctoral School of Social Sciences. It is created and produced by school fellows.